craving for products made in the United States has already began to accelerate.
Can a Chinese company help U.S. businesses grow? It's Wednesday, January 11th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You're a part of the program. Join us on our VOA Asia Facebook page. Also ahead, a former U.S. intelligence chief speaks with VOA. Are you getting fake or real news? Old wounds remain in Japan and South Korea. Smog may cloud your future. Stay with us. We're just getting started on VOA Asia. We heard on our program yesterday from the head of China's e-commerce giant Alibaba, Jack Ma, who was just coming out of his meeting in New York with President-elect Donald Trump. Ma wants to create a win-win arrangement by selling American products to people throughout Asia on Alibaba's online marketplace while creating hundreds of thousands of U.S. jobs.
Yes, very productive meeting. We discussed about the helping the American small business selling things through Alibaba platform to China and to Asia. So we mainly talk about small business and young people and American agriculture products to China. And we also think that China-USA relationship should be strengthened, should be more friendly and do better. I think the door is open that we can open discussing the relationship and trade issues. I think the president-elect, he's very smart, he's very open-minded listening. So I tell him my ideas about how can improve the trade, especially supporting small business, you know, cross-border trading and business.
According to Bloomberg News, Alibaba's strategy has long been to bring more foreign goods to the growing Chinese consumer market. It already makes available Pacific Northwest cherries, Washington State apples, and Alaskan seafood. University of Chicago political science professor Dali Yang spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about the Alibaba strategy.
For years, Alibaba's success has rested on Chinese businesses selling to the rest of the world. But of course, as consumption has grown in China, as Chinese purchases or the middle class has grown, the craving for products made in the United States has already began to accelerate. So as a result, what he's doing, what he's saying is he invites many American businesses to set up shop on Alibaba to sell to China. And it's good for his business, and of course it's good for the politics of his and also that of the president-elect.
Mr. Ma specifically said farmers and small clothing makers in the Middle West of the United States should use the Alibaba online marketplace to reach Chinese consumers.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting because a lot of the Midwestern states in particular have voted for the president-elect and all that. And of course, any signal to send to those states would be useful politically for Jack Ma. The other thing is also that we do know, for example, the appetite of Chinese consumers for things such as tea cans and a lot of other products have been very, very robust in recent years. And in fact, prices for those products have also risen substantially, partly because of the Chinese demand. This would be very welcome for the producers. The challenge, of course, is we better make sure that the customers' clearances, agricultural inspections are in place as well.
This meeting is the first bit of good news, really, since the election. Mr. Trump, of course, has taken a rather strong line against China, threatening to impose import tariffs on Chinese goods, saying that China has stiffed the U.S. through currency manipulation and illegal subsidies. Also, you had the conversation with Taiwan's president. So is this good news?
I think definitely. Of course, he also appointed an ambassador nominee to Beijing, who actually has a friendship with the Chinese president. So he's willing to talk. And of course, Mr. Jack Ma has been friendly with the Chinese government. So in essence, whatever he has spoken at the meeting is not only important in terms of business, but also in terms of Mr. Jack Ma serving as some sort of a go-between between the Trump administration and the Chinese government.
Dali Yang said despite some tough rhetoric between Mr. Trump and Beijing, trade relations remain robust with growing American exports to China and increased Chinese investments in the United States. These are some of the top stories that are currently trending on our VOA Asia website. Chinese Communist Party introduces rules for graft probes and supervision.
international pressure building on South Korea during impeachment turmoil. Taiwan courts Central America after U.S. visit angers China. As Jakarta sinks, government pins hopes on bird-shaped seawall. Indian slum dwellers pushed to city fringes face leaking pipes and lost jobs. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the VOA Asia Facebook page, also on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Ours is a new program. VOA presents Asia news in regional languages daily. We bring you some of those stories that you may not otherwise hear, but are sure to be interesting in your daily life. Just before we began VOA Asia this week, we heard from David Petraeus, former director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency and a highly decorated four-star general, in an exclusive interview with VOA. Petraeus was also considered by President-elect Donald Trump for Secretary of State, that, of course, the top U.S. diplomatic post. So, of course, he had many comments on U.S. policy in Asia. And in light of some of Mr. Trump's social media comments, specifically the U.S. position on China and Taiwan.
Well, I think this has to be very, very carefully balanced. There has to be recognition of what took place, really, back indeed when the Beijing and China, mainland China, was recognized as the China, and the policies that we have followed since that time. We have to remember the One China policy, also the Taiwan Relations Act. We've got to honor these and again, determine how to move forward in a way that is as cooperative as is possible between the two biggest countries in the world in economic terms, U.S. and China, again, while still honoring also the commitments in the Taiwan Relations Act. China has become much more important after a decade in which they did something that no country in the world has ever done, which is achieve double-digit GDP growth in every single year, with the exception perhaps during the Great Recession. It's really quite an extraordinary accomplishment, and it was more than a decade because it started well before that. And impressive growth has continued.
David Petraeus also told us that it's clear relations will evolve as China does.
China faces the great transition, and they're now having to go through that as they transition from low-cost labor provider to the world to more value-added and services as part of their economy, as they deal with the environmental degradation, as they deal with shadow banking, corruption, with a demographic downturn, with the highest debt-to-GDP ratio in aggregate in the world. All of these different challenges, indeed, with a backdrop of extraordinary accomplishments. And we've got to figure out how China can rise and continue to rise as it deserves to and has earned the right to do without the competition, understandable competition with the United States, ending up in something that is much more than just occasional disagreements.
Given his extensive 37-year military background, David Petraeus also has thoughts on China's buildup in the South China Sea, which has implications for everyone living in coastal nations because of the many maritime activities that bring food and move people and products.
It has carried out what I think, from our perspective, can only be characterized as quite aggressive actions in the South China Sea and to some degree in the East China Sea. So you have both collaboration and cooperation on an extraordinary scale, unlike any other in the world, but you also have competition as a rising power wants to, understandably, assert itself more on the international scene, take its place as it has grown to be the number two economy of the world, as its military develops more expeditionary capabilities and so forth. But that has to be done without ending up in conflict with the world's biggest power still. And let's not forget that when it comes to aircraft carriers and flat deck ships, the U.S. has more than all the rest of the world put together. So yes, in relative terms, China has been coming up and they're almost spending perhaps a third of what we spend in defense now, which is a considerable increase. But the U.S. military, the U.S. economy, the vibrancy of this country, and the revolutions that are ongoing in the information technology, manufacturing, energy, life sciences, this is an extraordinary country. And I think it's going to continue to be for the foreseeable future.
The exclusive VOA interview with David Petraeus is on YouTube and also on our website at voanews.com. Be sure to check out the VOA Asia Facebook while you're online and like us. Happening now in Asia, Chinese President Xi Jinping will become the first head of state to attend the World Economic Forum in Davos. The forum this year focuses on globalization, and it's expected Xi will share how China would take a responsive and responsible leadership role in global affairs. Stay up to date with Asia Minute, produced daily by VOA Asia's Steve Miller. Fake news has been in the news quite a bit lately, as we've seen a lot of fabricated stories online, either in print or with photos, suggesting things that may appear real but are not real. And this is really becoming quite a problem now in Indonesia. As Eva Masriva joins us in the studio to explain, you've done a story on this?
Yes, we've done many stories on this kind of issue because the hoax sites now really... I mean, it's increased in Indonesia, and people so worry about it because people cannot differentiate anymore which one is the correct one, which one is the hoax. That's why the government right now tried to close down some sites which they think trigger insecurity and also create chaos in the society.
Obviously, fake news can present a lot of problems.
Correct.
For the government. You know, things just aren't true, or people think the government is doing, but it isn't.
Yes. Yes. If I may explain to you about the background of this site. The first of all is because in Indonesia, there's also the growing of radicalism. So the radicalism in Indonesia, I don't know why suddenly people start to suspicious one to each other. More people worry about, you know, that there are hundreds, like 800 Indonesians going to Syria and Iraq, join the ISIS, and then they're coming back. Mm-hmm. They also spread this kind of radicalism among themselves, their neighborhood, their cities, in the villages. And our rule of law is not as strict as what we need, that it is supposed to be. So they can create news by this kind of thing because of the growing of the intolerance too. By creating this kind of sites.
You told me a very interesting story about the president and an incident that created a lot of fake news from
yes.
something very innocent that happened.
Correct. Even small stories can become very big, as if it was a true one, but it's a hoax. A couple of days ago, the Indonesian President Joko Widodo was interviewed in a local TV station, and they put a clip on in his ear to make sure that he can listen to the producer on the screen. Yeah. And suddenly the clip-on was fell in his chest. And some photographers, of course, they will take picture of anything the president do, they will take
right.
pictures. And that clip-on looked like a cross.
Oh, like a cross
like a
that
cross,
Christians
correct.
Would wear.
Yes, yes, the cross that the Christian mm-hmm. would wear. And suddenly the news become, well, actually our president is a Christian. And then Jokowi is a Christian. Jokowi is not a Muslim. So Indonesian most populous Muslim countries in the world was led by Christians, this kind
right,
of thing.
Right.
And it became a big hoo-ha. But actually, the president said, hi, this is just a clip-on. It's nothing to do with me as a one.
Fake news, a big problem in Indonesia, as it is in many parts of the world. But we get the real news from Eva Masriva in our Indonesian service and
thank
all
so
of our
much.
Great reporters in Indonesia. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia, courtesy of Steve Miller's Asia Minute. Flooding in southern Thailand has killed 25 people. Heavy rains continue to pound the region, affecting over a million people. In addition, regional railways have been severed for days. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia.
In 2015, South Korea and Japan entered into a deal that was supposed to resolve the long-standing differences the governments had about the women mobilized for sexual slavery between 1919 and 1945. A new diplomatic row between Seoul and Tokyo highlights how many in South Korea still aren't supportive of the agreement. VOA Asia's Steve Miller is here with more.
Diplomatic tensions are on the rise between South Korea and Japan over the long-standing comfort woman issue, something that was supposed to be finally and irreversibly resolved when Seoul and Tokyo reached an agreement in 2015. This week, Japan recalled its ambassador and consul general over a dispute that arose when a private group installed a statue of a young girl adjacent to the Japanese consulate in Busan. Japan had requested a similar statue be removed from its Seoul location as part of the 2015 deal as well, but the South Korean government said it could not force a private entity to move the statue. Daniel Pinkston, an international relations lecturer at Troy University in Seoul, tells VOA on Skype that while the agreement between Park and Abe was supposed to be final, it may be harder to achieve that result.
Well, there are a number of political actors in South Korea, and also in Japan for that matter, who use this issue for their own personal political agenda. And some groups, some politicians, some NGOs, further their interests by keeping this issue alive. The frustration on my part is the fact that this was not resolved satisfactorily, in my view. I think the way it was handled was insufficient. I think that from a humanitarian perspective, I think the most important thing is to address the feelings and the concerns and the human rights abuses that these survivors suffered so many decades ago.
Via Skype, Catherine Moon, a non-resident scholar at the Brookings Institution and professor at Wellesley College, added,
"The comfort women issue is a deep-seated one, and also it has captured the country's nationalist imagination, you could say. So given those two factors, and given the fact that the elderly women are very rapidly leaving us, there is a sense of the wrong needing to be righted in the way that the women would feel comfortable. But there's also this reality. No matter what, in my opinion, Japan were to do in order to make amends with South Korea, I don't think you would find 100% of South Koreans ever happy."
And that is something apparent when looking at events in South Korea. This week, a monk perished from self-immolation, and the leader of the Democratic Party in the National Assembly called for South Korea to terminate the agreement with Japan. Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
At this hour in Asia, Claire Hollingworth, a British war correspondent who was the first to report the Nazi invasion of Poland that marked the beginning of World War II, has died. She was 105. The Foreign Correspondents Club of Hong Kong announced her death. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Check out Steve Miller's Asia Minute as well. Now on VOA Asia. This past October, nearly 200 nations signed the Paris Climate Accords. Among the signatories were the United States and China, two nations that represent about 40% of the world's carbon emissions. The goal of the accords is to slow the rate that the world is burning planet-warming carbon and pumping it into the atmosphere. Much of that comes from coal-burning power plants. But in places like China, it's not only about giant power plants. In some cases, ending the burning of coal will mean a door-to-door effort to change old habits. The clouds are forcing people to wear masks outside to keep from breathing the tiny bits of unhealthy particulate matter floating in the haze. Government and environmentalists say the smog is coming from coal. Beijing is trying to restrict its use in the frigid northern parts of China. Yet between 1950 and 1980, coal was given to residents for free. And it's still the way that many in the north, like Yao Junhua of Xinan, keep warm.
I don't think burning coal for heating can cause terrible air pollution. I think it is unfair for them to blame us as the source of pollution. We burn very little coal in villages.
Environmentalists say both giant plants and small stoves contribute to the problem. Ma Jun is director of the Institute of Public and Environmental Affairs in China.
But for the surrounding areas, it is not necessarily the case that coal burning for household heating is the main source of pollution. The main source of pollution is steel factories and heavy industries, and our priority should be given to shutting down these major polluters.
The Chinese government has invested billions in clean energy and recently announced an environmental police force to find and punish polluters in Beijing. Some Beijing residents, like Chan Yan, are frustrated by having to live their life in a haze.
I believe we will eventually resolve the air pollution problem. But the thing is, how long does it take for them to fix this? If they need a few decades, my child will live under the smog all his life, and I will end my life in smog as well. If so, where's the hope?
Unfortunately, not much immediate hope as long as coal remains the cheapest way to stay warm. Thanks to Kevin Enix for bringing us that story. You can see the video at voanews.com and on Facebook at VOA Asia. You've been listening to VOA Asia. We invite you to like us on Facebook and follow us at voanews.com as well. Thanks so much for joining us today. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer Thomas Blondet, our managing editor is Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Enjoy the day ahead. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From time to time, the United States identifies certain individuals as crucial to the operation of terrorist organizations. Most often, these are top leaders, or they help finance terrorist organizations. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. When such people are identified, the U.S. government places their name on the specially designated nationals list. Their assets within U.S. jurisdiction are immediately frozen, and they are locked out of the global financial network. No U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with a designated individual. In this way, the United States disrupts financial support networks for terrorists and terrorist organizations. In early January, the United States Department of State named as a specially designated global terrorist Hamza bin Laden, a son of global terrorist and founder of the Al-Qaeda terror network Osama bin Laden. Hamza bin Laden, born around 1989, was officially named an Al-Qaeda member in a 2015 audio message by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who has headed the terror group since the 2011 death of Osama bin Laden. As part of the same audio message, Hamza bin Laden threatened attacks against the United States as well as Americans abroad. He also called for lone offender attacks against U.S., French, and Israeli interests in Washington, Paris, and Tel Aviv. Similarly, in a message issued in the summer of 2016, Hamza bin Laden called on tribes based in Saudi Arabia to unite with al-Qaeda's affiliate in Yemen and together to wage war against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The State Department's designation serves notice globally that Hamza bin Laden is actively engaged in terrorism. Designations of terrorist individuals and groups expose and isolate them and serve as a useful tool to assist or complement the law enforcement actions of other U.S. agencies as well as other governments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.